Iran fires ballistic and cruise missiles on the second day of its largest-scale military drills in the Persian Gulf.
All the weapons and equipment used in today's drills, including missiles, are made in Iran.
Russian President Vladimir Putin blames the West for escalating tensions in Europe, stressing that Moscow will respond to any Western aggression. European and British gas prices rise sharply to all-time highs on strong winter demand and simmering tensions with key supplier, Russia. This is World News. I'm Behrouz Sanjafi. Welcome. Top story this hour, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a second day of large-scale military drills in the southern parts of the country. Well, the IRGC's Navy forces successfully fired anti-ship cruise missiles, destroying mock enemy vessels. They also flew assault drones to destroy fixed and mobile targets. The five-day maneuvers, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, are underway in the Persian Gulf, the state of Hormuz, and the coast of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The drills involve a variety of IRGC units. Iran regularly holds military drills to enhance the combat readiness of its armed forces. Iranian military experts and technicians have recently made great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. A commander of the IRGC's Navy, Rear Admiral Alireza Tangsiri, says that all the weapons used in the drills are made in Iran.
The drills, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, is being conducted in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz by the IRGC. One of the areas IRGC forces today are protecting is the Nasiat Islands. As you saw, we're fully prepared defense. Our forces on the island destroyed mock enemy targets trying to attack their positions, and no fixed or mobile targets were able to reach the island. This shows their operational power. All the weapons and equipment used in today's drills, including missiles, are made in Iran. Our capabilities are increasing every year. Compared to last year's drills, our forces were more prepared and their weapons have been upgraded.
Okay, now this is special coverage of Data Store. Let me invite a couple of guests to see what they think about this and get some insight. I'll be joined by Sameh Torabi, director of the Rosala Strategic Studies Institute in the city of Qom, over the phone. Also, Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert, who's joining us out of Madison. Good to have you both, gentlemen. Let's go to the Iranian city of Qom. This is not the first time Iran is conducting military drills. This has been going on regularly, as you know. But maybe there is some special significance at this special juncture of time. Let's have your comments on that.
Sure. A particular time as it regards Iran, because, we have countries that are constantly threatening Iran. The U.S. and Israel being the two countries that constantly threaten Iran. So in that sense, Iran has to periodically show what it has in terms of its military capability to remind those countries of what the price would be if they did attack.
Now, Kevin, as you heard the IRGC Navy commander reminding that maybe there's some news to some of our audience that all of those military hardware used in the drills are made in Iran. And also, let's not forget the fact that all this achievement has been made in the presence of U.S. what it calls maximum pressure campaign and all those sanctions.
Well, actually, the maximum pressure campaign and the sanctions have backfired in a number of ways, and chiefly by forcing Iran to become self-sufficient, to learn how to do this stuff. And in fact, that's allowed Iran to pursue its course towards genuine sovereignty and independence far more effectively than it would have if it hadn't been sanctioned. It would have been stuck buying things from other countries, becoming dependent on the military hardware of other countries, as well as economic factors, And Iran could have gotten stuck, or at least half stuck, in the situation that so many countries around the world are stuck in, especially Islamic countries that are essentially dependencies on the Anglo-Zionist Empire. Whereas Iran, because it was sanctioned, and the reason it was sanctioned was its dedication to becoming genuinely sovereign and independent, was forced to learn how to do these technologies itself, and it's done very well. And we've seen repeated indications that the forces of the empire are unwilling to attack Iran in a big way. The murder of General Soleimani nearly triggered the war that they didn't want, and they had to sit and allow Iranian missiles to rain down on an American base to get out of that war. The Atlantic magazine ran a simulation in 2003 showing that the U.S. loses if it fights Iran, and the Israelis know they're going to lose even worse unless they can somehow drag the Americans in, and even then they might lose. So Iran has done a terrific job at building up genuinely defensive forces, not threatening any neighbors, not threatening other countries, not going around the world trying to impose its system on everybody else the way the U.S. does, and I assume that these defenses will get stronger and stronger as time goes on.
Okay, thanks a lot for that. Samah Tutarabi, director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute in Qom. On the phone, and Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert in medicine, joined us in this special coverage. Now, moving on, Iran's Yemen ambassador, Hassan Irlou, has died due to complications from COVID-19, and Tehran says the envoy could not receive timely medical treatment because certain countries delayed his evacuation from Yemen. Here's a look at his profile.
Hassan Irlou was born in 1959 in Shahrareh, a small town near Tehran. After the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, he joined the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was a veteran of the Iran-Iraq War and had been suffering from complications of chemical attacks. Irlou went on to become a senior diplomat. After Yemen's conflict broke out in 2015, he was transferred to Department for Yemen's Affairs at Iran's Foreign Ministry, where he served as deputy assistant to the minister. During that period, Irlou coordinated the transfer of Iranian humanitarian aid to Yemen in cooperation with the United Nations. In October 2020, he was appointed as Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government. In that portfolio, Irlou focused his efforts on unifying resistance groups and strived for national reconciliation. He encouraged Yemeni political groups to resolve their internal disputes through dialogue. The senior diplomat also worked towards garnering international support for mechanisms that would end the Yemen conflict and lift the blockade imposed by the Saudi military coalition. Irlou was diagnosed with COVID-19 days before he was transferred to Tehran from Sana'a to receive medical treatment. But by the time he arrived at a hospital in Iran's capital on Sunday, his condition had worsened irrevocably. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that's because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a. Khatibzadeh did not name any specific country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies in the war have been keeping Yemen under a blockade since 2015. The main airport in Sana'a has been closed for more than 5 years now. Hassan Irlou passed away on Tuesday morning due to complications from COVID-19. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has expressed its condolences to Tehran.
The Russian president blaming the West for escalating tensions in Europe, citing NATO's eastward expansion and the U.S. withdrawal from missile defense treaties. Vladimir Putin is saying that Washington's judgment has been clouded by euphoria after what it regarded as its victory in the Cold War. He also warned that Russia is prepared to take military technical measures in response to unfriendly Western actions over Ukraine. Western governments have recently been accusing Moscow of planning to invade Ukraine, citing Russia's military buildup near the border. Russia has denied that claim. In turn, it demanded legal guarantees over its security from the U.S. and NATO. Early in the day, a senior Russian diplomat said that contacts have begun between Moscow and Washington on the security issue, and he said that there was a possibility that the two sides would reach an understanding. We were joined by author and researcher Greg Simons a short time ago, and he cast a doubt on the possibility of Russia reaching a meaningful agreement with the U.S. and NATO on the existing security concerns.
There's no point in looking at the issue that NATO and the U.S. are separate. The U.S. calls the shots in NATO, and they have been continually violating promises stemming from the promise to Gorbachev, which Matlock, the former ambassador to the USSR, has stated on many occasions. And if we look at it contemporarily, US promises and guarantees and even signed treaties and negotiations mean nothing. I mean, Iran knows this with the JCPOA, the different nuclear treaties which have been violated by the United States unilaterally. So these are worthless, and I doubt that they will actually make any agreement.
Well, let's take a look at Europe. The energy crisis there is just getting worse. Natural gas prices are skyrocketing to new all-time highs, and a strong winter demand as much of the continent is bracing for sub-zero temperatures. The Dutch trading platform, TTF's natural gas price, soared by over 10% from Monday. Price in the UK also leapt to a fresh record peak. Price in both markets are seven times higher than the figures reported at the beginning of the year. Analysts blame the spike on simmering tensions with key supplier Russia, which provides one-third of Europe's total gas supplies. They believe that ongoing controversy surrounding Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline also plays a role in the crisis. The project has faced a stiff opposition from the U.S. and some European countries. Europe's natural gas crisis comes amid soaring prices for electricity in a number of countries, including France. Well, also, Europe is witnessing a surge in COVID cases amid the spread of the Omicron variant. Russia saying that some 26,000 people tested positive for the coronavirus in the past day. And that includes 41 Omicron cases. It's imposed restrictions on travelers coming from South Africa, where the variant was first detected. Danish health officials say that Omicron is the predominant variant in their country. France also announced a record surge in its cases.
We have broken records in terms of infection rates, which today stands at 537 cases per 100,000 inhabitants in our country, which is once again a record. The situation in hospitals is tense, with nearly 16,000 people hospitalized, more than 3,000 people in intensive care. The Omicron variant, as I said, is arriving in our country. This weekend, we estimated that 10% of the contaminations detected in our country were linked to the Omicron variant. We are probably beyond that today.
Germany has reported over 23,000 new cases and 462 more related deaths. The Robert Koch Institute recommended imposing maximum contact restrictions at once to fight a looming tide of infections caused by Omicron. The body also recommended restricting travel only to what was absolutely necessary. Federal and state leaders are due to meet later on Tuesday to decide on the new measures. Omicron was first detected on November 24th. It's spread to nearly 90 countries. Preliminary study by South African scientists suggesting that Omicron is highly transmissible. It may evade some immunity to COVID-19. China is imposing fresh sanctions on the U.S. in another tit-for-tat spat between the two sides. This time, Beijing has barred members of an American religious group from entering China. The foreign ministry says four people from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom are facing the ban. These individuals will not be able to enter China's mainland, Hong Kong, and Macau. Their assets will be frozen, and then they'll be barred from dealing with Chinese citizens and institutions. Weeks ago, the U.S. slapped sanctions on a number of Chinese people and entities for alleged human rights abuses in the Xinjiang region. Beijing denies these allegations and demands Washington correct its mistakes.
By imposing illegal sanctions on Chinese officials on the alibi of the so-called human rights issues in Xinjiang, the United States has gravely interfered in China's internal affairs, violated the basic norms governing international relations, and seriously harmed the China-U.S. relations. China resolutely opposes and strongly condemns it.
Well, relations between China and the U.S. have been tense recently. They are at odds over a host of issues, including trade, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and even the origins of COVID-19. The latest in the retaliatory moves was the U.S. boycott of Beijing Winter Olympics, a virtual summit between U.S. President Biden and his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, in November produced no breakthroughs either. Afghans have held a protest rally in the capital, Kabul, to demand a U.S. release the country's frozen assets amid a dire economic crisis.
We have gathered here to call on the U.S. to release our blocked assets. The international community should not be indifferent to the ongoing humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. Prices are going up and people are dealing with difficulties. We will continue our protests until the U.S. frees our money.
This protest is aimed at showing our anger against the U.S. for freezing Afghanistan's money. It's not the asset of the government. It's the money of the Afghan poor and vulnerable people. It's the salary of teachers and workers. People don't have anything to eat nowadays.
Hundreds of protesters hit the streets and marched on the shuttered U.S. embassy in Kabul. They called for the release of billions of dollars of assets blocked by the U.S. following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan in mid-August. International funding has also been suspended since then. That has battered the country's already troubled economy, leading to a rise in poverty. The United Nations has warned that the Afghan economy is in, quote, free fall, and it may pull the entire population with it if decisive and compassionate actions aren't taken immediately. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yalda the Longest Night. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are used to exhuming relics when we research on ancient ethnicities. When speaking of relics, we remind of potsherds that cannot be used anymore. They should be kept in museums under special care and conditions. Relics are the remnants of civilizations. History is something beyond potsherds and decayed bones. Some customs have remained for several millennia. Yalda Night is one of these customs, which has lived for some 7,000 years. Yalda means generation and birth in Aramaic language. The ancient peoples of the Iranian plateau believed that on Yalda Night, the seeds of plants sprout and from day after the night, the sun would shine longer and longer to make them delve the soil and come out. That's why our ancestors used to keep vigil the night and enjoy themselves till morning as a sign of thanksgiving to God for helping them in their agriculture. In some periods in ancient times, the Yalda night, or as we say, Shabe Chele or Chele night, got such significance that Zoroastrians founded Mithraism, or worship of the sun, on its basis. This creed spread to Hinduism later on so that they considered the sun and the solar goddesses as the most powerful deities. Some researchers are of the opinion that Prophet Jesus' birthday in January in early winter is also based on this custom. Thus, many people have founded their life on this basis throughout centuries. However, today this custom has just one meaning for us, namely spending a memorable night with our dear and near ones. In view of this, Iranians gather together on Yalda night and spend happy moments with their relatives and friends. They sit together and usually open the Divan of Hafez for an augury, as if they consulted this great poet for their future. The poems of Hafez are full of hope and love, hence making the reader hopeful and giving him motive for further endeavor in life for a better future. In addition to Hafez, younger ones sit around grandparents to listen to the accounts of the past in the form of sweet stories. These stories include the epics of heroes and myths of the past. Some elderly open the Shahnameh of Ferdowsi and read parts of it. On the Yalda night, children and teenagers are eager to listen to the memories of grandparents and the elderly. Some of the elderly make sweet moments for them by relating interesting accounts of the past. This gathering is always accompanied by pomegranate, watermelon, nuts, sweets, snacks, and other tasty edibles. Iranians usually go to their grandparents or parents on the Yalda night, thus the gathering consists of uncles, aunts, cousins, and so on. On the Yalda night, many people try to share their happiness with the poor and the needy. Therefore, they buy sweets, pomegranate, nuts, and even clothes to make them happy. This gives a human and religious hue to ancient customs and teaches altruism to younger generation. This is true with Nowruz too, when many people try to share their happiness with the deprived strata of the society. Yaldonite is an opportunity to think on the beauties of nature and the endless power of God. It is the longest night of the year and good opportunity to muse on the system of creation and the Creator. We appeal to God to help us and save us from negligence so that we always remember His bounties and blessing to us. Amen.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين بارئ الخلائق أجمعين بعث الأنبياء والمرسلين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. The topic this Fatimiyya has been having a connection, an emotional connection with Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha. We said that we want to talk about the emotional connection and relationship with Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha. This is important for us. One of the points that was mentioned, and I think I'll highlight this one, this was, I think I can say, most important. In the context of the battle with the kuffar, with the enemies of Islam, with the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt, we have seen warriors like Hajj Qasim, may Allah bless his soul, this great shaheed. We are reaching the anniversary of this Shahada of Hajj Abu Mahdi and Hajj Qasim, rahmatullah alayhima wa ridwanullah ta'ala alayhima. When we read, when we see, when we watch their connection to Fatima al-Zahra salamullahi alayha, in the most difficult of times, dire needs, times where it seemed like everything is over, tawassul to Fatima al-Zahra. And those who have been through this, those who've been part of this struggle against the enemies of Islam, and they've continued it, and they've faced situations where they know what dire situations means, and they have experienced tawassul to Fatima al-Zahra, they understand why it is said that the Ahlul Bayt, salamullah alayhim ajma'in, according to their own words, when they were in difficult times in the struggle, they went to Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, and asked her for help. They sought intercession through her. And those times, one begins to understand why at those times, those most difficult of times, the heart of a believer who is in touch with Fatima al-Zahra, who has that emotional connection with her, is able to remember her, ask for help, and keep going. And after that tawassul, one realizes that they're still going. I think I've mentioned this before. One of the shuhada, great shuhada of the war that the international community had against the Islamic Republic, in that war, there were many shuhada, many great shuhada, many of them had very special connections with Fatimatu Zahra Salamullahi Alayha. One of them is Shahid Burunsi. Shahid Burunsi was a construction worker, maybe to a certain degree, we could call him a contractor, but not the way we think, you know, big con. No, someone had maybe has a couple workers working with him, and he's got his expertise in a certain arena or area of construction. I don't know exactly what that was, but he was a professional construction or someone with expertise in construction in a certain area of it. Not that he had been educated in that, just through experience, the old time type of, you know, construction work. And he was part of the revolution, very, very religious, very spiritual. And when the war started, he went to the war fronts and was involved. In one of the operations they had when they were going towards the Ba'athists, they got caught in a minefield. These minefields are deadly. They were supposed to be cleared out by others, but something had happened and that had not happened. And so they had to get through this for Islam. And here they are. They don't have a way. And it's pitch black, complete darkness. He pleads to Fatimatu Zahra, salamullahi alayha, asks her for help with this understanding. And he gets a response in a way that he can hear. This is mentioned, there's witnesses to this. No one else could hear her. But Fatimatu Zahra spoke to him. And she said, "You get your soldiers, I will guide you, listen to me." He didn't see, he heard her. And he told his soldiers to follow every step very carefully. And they got through that minefield with the guidance of Fatimatu Zahra. These are examples, of course. Fatimatu Zahra, who can guide these soldiers of Islam fighting the Ba'athist Saddam and all those who backed him in those difficult times, she can guide them through a minefield. They cannot see where mines are. Any step in the wrong direction would completely jeopardize a mission and they would be dying. Fatimatu Zahra, who can do this, can guide people in the minefield of Jihadun Nafs. We have plenty of minefields, plenty of them. We hit these things, we have no idea. If I go this way, there may be an explosion. I go that way, I don't know what to do, I don't know what the direction is. Ask Fatimatu Zahra, salamullahi alayha. With that understanding, she can help. The minefield of ideological warfare, cultural warfare, all the various forms of warfare for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this jihad fi sabilillah that we're all part of one way or another, some more than others. Fatimatu Zahra, salamullahi alayha, can guide us through this. She can. If we have that understanding, she will speak and we can hear. If we don't have that understanding, we cannot tap into that. We will never tap into it. We will never look into it. We will never speak to her in that way. We will never ask her in that way. And if she speaks to us with our deficiency, with that thought process of ours, which does not see her present, does not see her involved, does not see her capable, then I'm not going to hear. Not because she didn't speak, it's because I didn't hear. My ears were deaf. She did speak. Inshallah, we go through that and we're able to, inshallah, hear her. And hear her guidance, inshallah.
أسعفيني بفيضك المعطاء.
إن له سلمي إلى العليا فامنحي نفحة الحياة يا سبيلي إلى النجاة يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
فاطم الزهراء
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former Senator David Perdue knows how to crash a party.
when he announced that he would seek the 2022 Republican nomination for governor in Georgia, challenging the incumbent Brian Kemp, he did more than enter a primary race. The article you're about to hear has been written by Matthew Continetti, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and the author of the book, The Right, The 100-Year War for American Conservatism. The article has been published by the New York Times, and it's titled, Will Trump Ruin a Red Wave in 2022? Former Senator David Perdue knows how to crash a party. When he announced that he would seek the 2022 Republican nomination for governor of Georgia, challenging the incumbent Brian Kemp, he did more than enter a primary race. He illustrated the dangers facing the GOP in the coming year. Georgia Republicans are divided over former President Donald Trump and torn between mainstream credibility and the conspiratorial fringe. David Perdue, an ally of Donald Trump, has made these divisions worse. The beneficiary, the Democrat Stacey Abrams. Republicans worry about internal strife and outlandish messages that turn off swing voters because everything else is going their way. The party did well in last month's elections. President Biden's low approval ratings endanger Democrats in Congress, where Republicans must net only 5 seats in the House of Representatives and 1 in the Senate to seize control. Republican strength at the state level gives the party an advantage in drawing new maps of congressional districts, which will amplify their slim lead in the 538 estimate of the congressional generic ballot. Yet history shows how expectations can be thwarted. Republicans have experienced hopeful times before, only to have the moment pass. They believed that disapproval of President Bill Clinton's conduct would expand their majorities in 1998. They ended up losing 5 House seats. They believed that Donald Trump would rally the base to support 2 incumbent senators during runoffs in Georgia last January. But they lost both seats and control of the Senate. Time and again, the biggest obstacle to a red wave hasn't been the Democratic Party. In fact, it's been the Republican Party. Republican victories in the midterms next year are far from preordained. Glenn Youngkin's win in Virginia may be much harder to replicate elsewhere than it looked on election night. Republican leaders continue to fear Donald Trump and his supporters, and they are divided over candidate selection, message and agenda. The result is a unique combination of external strength and internal rot. An enthusiastic and combative Republican Party that, despite its best efforts, may soon acquire power it has done nothing to deserve. It will be hard for the party to appeal to the suburban independents who decide elections. Though, Mr. Youngkin's success suggests a path. He is the first Republican elected governor of Virginia in over a decade because of his emphasis on kitchen table issues like rising prices and school closures. He ignored immigration, encouraged vaccination while opposing government mandates and stayed clear of Donald Trump during the general election. He focused on parental involvement in education and planted himself firmly in the center-right of the political mainstream. When asked about a Trump rally where the Pledge of Allegiance was recited to a flag supposedly connected to the 6th of January riot at the U.S. Capitol, Mr. Youngkin called it weird and wrong. One Republican senator joked in private that Greg Youngkin had figured out how to hold Donald Trump's hand under the table and in the dark. Other candidates won't be as skilled or as lucky as Glenn Youngkin. Republicans lost winnable Senate seats in 2010 and 2012 because of flawed nominees like Sharon Angle in Nevada, Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, Todd Akin in Missouri, and Richard Murdoch in Indiana. Past may be prologue if Republicans nominate Donald Trump allies whose record or rhetoric are questionable and extreme. Last month, one Trump-endorsed candidate for Senate, Sean Parnell of Pennsylvania, suspended his campaign after he lost a custody battle against his estranged wife. The Trump endorsees, Kelly Shibaka of Alaska and Herschel Walker of Georgia, are untested on the campaign trail. In races where Donald Trump hasn't yet endorsed, Blake Masters of Arizona, Eric Greitens of Missouri, and J.D. Vance of Ohio may secure the MAGA base by forfeiting viability in the general election. Donald Trump remains the central figure in the GOP. Party elites try to ignore him as he spends many days fighting Republicans rather than Democrats and plotting his revenge against the 10 Republican House members who voted for his second impeachment. The 7 Republican senators who voted to convict him and the 13 House Republicans who voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Donald Trump targets his enemies with primary challenges, calls for audits and decertification of the 2020 presidential results, and howls at Mitch McConnell for not being tough. His imitators within the party are a font of endless infighting and controversy, and they undermine the authority of the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy. Mr. Trump would have it no other way. The former president was content to keep a distance in this year's races for governor. He won't be so quiet next year, especially if he concludes that a successful midterm election is a key step to his restoration to power in 2024. A more visible and vocal Donald Trump has the potential to help Republicans in solid red states, but doom them in purple or blue states. Yet control of the Senate hinges on the results in Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and New Hampshire, states that Donald Trump lost in 2020. Glenn Youngkin showed that a positive message attuned to a middle-class priorities repels Democratic attacks. If Republicans campaign on a unified message that applies conservative principles to inflation, the border, crime, education, and healthcare, they might be able to avoid being tagged as the party of extremism, conspiracy theories, and loyalty to Donald Trump. Their problem is that they have no such message. Mitch McConnell has reportedly told Senate Republicans that they won't release an agenda before the midterm elections. He's worried that specific proposals are nothing but fodder for Democratic attacks. What should worry him more are rudderless Republican candidates who allow their Democratic opponents to define them negatively, and then, if they still win, take office in January of 2023 with no idea what to do. In an ideal world, more Republicans would think seriously about how best to provide individuals and families with the resources necessary to flourish in today's America. They would spend less time attacking one another and more time offering constructive approaches to inflation and dangerous streets. They would experiment with a ranked choice primary system that played a role in Glenn Youngkin's nomination in Virginia and in the law and order Democrat Eric Adams' win in New York City's mayoral race. Interested Republicans would declare today that Donald Trump won't deter them from seeking the presidency, reminding him that renomination is not guaranteed. But that's not the world that we live in, Republicans appear either unwilling or unable to treat the former president as a figure from the past, whose behavior has done the party more harm than good. They take false comfort in the idea that midterm elections are thermostatic, the inevitable repudiation, climatic in nature, of the governing party. They assume that they will win next year without doing anything of significance. And they may be right. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Ilam commemoration ceremony.
شهید ما در واقع مصداق و مظهر ان الله اشترى من المؤمنین انفسهم و اموالهم بان لهم الجنه.
Our martyrs are in fact the manifestation of this verse. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111. In other words, they have dealt with their lives with God. This is how martyrs are.
یا اون آیه شریفه صدقوا ما عهد الله عليه فمنهم من قضى نحبه ومنهم من ينتظر من المؤمنين رجال صدقوا ما وعد الله عليه.
There is another holy verse which says, among the faithful are men who fulfill what they have pledged to Allah. Of them are some who have fulfilled their pledge, and of them are some who still wait. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verse 23. They were true to the pledge they had made with God, the Exalted. A martyr is like this. Martyrdom is an act of making a pledge and dealing with God. That is why you see that the soldiers who are fighting in the way of God are different from other common soldiers in the world. Those of you who have witnessed the sacred defense and those of you who have read books on this topic surely know that the pious soldiers in the sacred defense, or the soldiers who have defended in other areas such as defending the holy shrines and the like, are purer during fighting and in the field of battle than at other times. They also rely more on God, show more humility, and observe the divine limits more carefully.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
در دنیا معمول است که وقتی یک لشکری پیروز میشد در یک شهری براشون غارت و چپاول و نمیدونم ظلم و این چیزا عادی است. اینجا نه خیر. اینجا رزمنده مجاهد فی سبیل الله در میدان جنگ اگر پیروز هم بشود، اخلاصش، رعایت حدود الهیش اندکی کم نمیشه، بلکه در حال پیروزی به خاطر شکرانه پیروزی این رعایت ها بیشتر میشه.
It is common in the world for a victorious army to loot, plunder, and inflict great cruelty in a city. But this is not the case for our soldiers. Even if those who fight in the way of God win, not only does their piety not decrease and they do not stop observing the divine limits, they are even more careful to observe God's limits because of their gratefulness for their victory. Our soldiers would take some of the enemy captive. This was the same enemy who would torture and harass our captives from the time they took them captive up until the time they entered the camp where they were to be kept. And it is clear what they did to them in those camps. But if our soldiers took those same people captive, they would heal them if they were injured, and they would give them water if they were thirsty. They would treat them as if they were one of themselves. So, these are very important points.
I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost, you've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.